Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we are tonight going to be wide awake as we talk about sleep. James Hertigan, MD, is Professor of Clinical Medicine and Medical Director of the Sleep Science Center at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And Kristen Knutson is a biomedical anthropologist and is a professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago, where also they've got a sleep lab and are very much concerned with sleep pathologies. James Hertigan gets about 6.5 hours of sleep a night. Kristen Knutson is wiser and gets a full 8 and sometimes even more. Do we really need 8 hours of sleep? How do you justify yourself, Dr. Hertigan?
By napping, actually.
Oh, then so you do get more sleep.
I do get more sleep than 6.5 hours, and I readily admit that a good afternoon nap helps a lot.
Then is it the case that it doesn't matter whether you do it all in one fell swoop or whether you apportion the hours out over 2 or 3 sessions?
It's not certain, but we feel that napping can help add additional sleep. If you can't get it all at night, then it's better to take a nap than to not.
Thinking about the program we're about to do, I remembered an occasion a number of years ago with my little grandson. He's now going on 14. He was then about 5 or going on 6. And they were visiting in town because they don't live here anymore. And I took him to the aquarium, the great aquarium down here in Chicago. And as we walked around looking at all sorts of things, he said to me, "Grandpa, do fish sleep?" And I realized I had no answer. I did not know whether fish sleep or not. After they went back home, and it kind of bugged me and bothered me. And I looked it up. I Googled it, I guess, or something. And I discovered that there's considerable scientific confusion as to whether fish and creatures of the deep sleep at all.
How sleep is measured is the difference. Like, human sleep is very characteristic with different sleep stages, and when you try to measure sleep in fish, it's going to look very different. But I can tell you there are people who study sleep in flies, and so most animals have some behavioral state that looks like sleep. It may not be the exact same and certainly isn't the same as what we see in humans.
But some behavioral state in which they become comparatively dormant.
Right, exactly.
And do they close their eyes?
If they have eyelids.
If they have eyes, they do. Are there any creatures that we know of in the animal kingdom who simply do not sleep?
None that I'm aware of. Of course, Dr. Knutson mentioned, sleep is very different among the species.
Well, what's the nature of the difference? If we look at our close relatives, if we look at chimps or bonobos or what have you, do they sleep just about the way we do?
Well, Dr. Knutson, anthropologist?
Yes. They're much more similar to humans, likely due to the fact that our brains are much more similar to one another than we are to fish or cats.
But if you go down to cats, you're going to get a very different kind of sleep, right?
Yes. And when we say different, it relates to these different sleep stages we keep referring to, non-REM versus REM sleep, and the distribution of these stages across the night if they have both stages.
Then it's time to come to REM, and indeed to Nathaniel Kleitman, who was the pride of the University of Chicago.
Absolutely.
Way back in 1953 when he and a graduate student of his discovered REM sleep. REM, of course, stands for rapid eye movement. What does that have to do with sleep?
Well, good question. We certainly need it to feel rested. There are some thoughts that it involves our memory processing, moving our short-term memories to long-term memories.
What does eye movement have to do with all of that?
Well, it's a physiological state. So sleep is characterized by different sleep stages, and it's a particular physiological state. Not only do we move our eyes or have rapid eye movement, but we also become atonic. Our muscles can't move, almost like we're paralyzed during that state of sleep.
And is it true that REM is also a direct correlate of dreaming?
Yes.
Still remains the scientific
understanding. You dream during non-REM sleep, but typically the more vivid dreams associated with more detailed imagery is associated more with REM sleep, whereas more mundane types of dreaming has been associated with the non-REM sleep.
Old Dr. Freud theorized that dreams are essentially wish fulfillment, and the function of the dream is to keep us asleep, because all that bothers us and that we can't really express in daily life because of our societally imposed inhibitions, we can indulge. Thus, sexual fantasies and aggression fantasies and so on can be indulged in the dream work, and that gets rid of all that pent-up energy, that pent-up need, so that you can remain in repose and sleep. The whole idea is now regarded, even among psychiatrists, as simply untrue, as just too simple and just wrong. But still, REMs must have some function. They must do something for us. What do they do?
Well, I wouldn't be Sigmund Freud, of course, to theorize upon it. But you're right. I do believe REM sleep has an important part. We do know that if you're sleep deprived, we tend to REM rebound. That is, we have longer periods of REM sleep if we're sleep deprived and catch up on our sleep. And I do believe we have some function in terms of memory processing associated with REM sleep.
Memory processing. What do we mean by that?
I think it's the ability to recall, to learn, to remember things from the past, and to have retention of those past experiences.
There are some creative people who, when they account for what they've achieved, whether in science or in literary art or otherwise, say that very often they're puzzled by or burdened by or frustrated by something they can't work out. And they go to sleep on it, and in sleep, they suddenly pop up into a moment of awareness, and they've got the solution. Or else they wake up in the morning and it's all there without any effort. Is that just essentially mythology, or does it sometimes happen?
No, there's some scientific evidence for that, where studies have shown that if you teach somebody a little task or computer test, mm-hmm. and you test them again 8 hours later, if they sleep in that interval between the two tests, they actually do a lot better than if they don't sleep. And so there is some learning going on while we're sleeping.
So some people have the problem of not being able to get to sleep. Mm-hmm. Here's one who is rather well known. This guy committed a murder. He killed, in fact, a king. And here he is talking about his insomnia a few days only after the murder of the king. This is Macbeth, of course, who says, "Methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more. Macbeth, does murder sleep? The innocent sleep, sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care. The death of each day's life, sore labor's bath, balm of hurt minds. Great nature's second course, chief nourisher in life's feast." Those are all the virtues of and all the gifts that come to us through sleep. Balm of hurt minds. But Macbeth can't get to sleep. He's burdened by the fact that he's killed the king. There must be other reasons why people are sometimes insomniac, apart from murdering kings. Let's talk about insomnia and related sleep disorders when we return right after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are talking about sleep tonight and many aspects of sleep, including its basic functionality. But now we're turning to sleep pathologies. I suppose insomnia is one of the major complaints that people in sleep clinics have to deal with.
Absolutely. Almost a third of the population has some insomnia at some point in their life. So yeah. It's a very common condition.
What do we make of that condition? What causes insomnia?
Well, so there's a list of perhaps 100 different things.
One is killing kings, I've already mentioned, but yeah. Most people who suffer from insomnia have not done regicide yet, have they?
I understand Shakespeare probably slept pretty well. But yeah. Stress, emotional stress, stress of the daily of our daily lives. It could be medical conditions, chronic pain conditions. Chronic health conditions that lead to sleep fragmentation and insomnia.
What sorts of health conditions might foster insomnia?
Well, so many individuals who have chronic pain, for example, arthritis, rheumatoid
arthritis.
Well, that would
do it for me, yeah.
Yes. But also heart disease, heart failure leads to disturbed sleep, frequent awakenings, chronic kidney disease, people who have to get up at night and urinate frequently can have disturbed sleep and then perpetuation of insomnia.
There's an old blues that goes, "Trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always because the sun's going to shine in my backyard someday." And then it goes on to talk about actually having difficulty sleeping, among other things. So just a troubled mind is enough to keep the mind awake.
Oh, absolutely. I think many people have experienced trying to fall asleep when they have some issue they're anxious about on their mind and they can't let it go and they keep thinking about it, and it does make falling asleep much more difficult. And it can be temporary, but for some individuals it becomes chronic and very debilitating to some degree, because not being able to sleep is a very frustrating experience.
I would think one way it might even become more chronic is once you know that you're having difficulty sleeping, you go to bed thinking, I'm not going to be able to sleep, or will I ever get to sleep, which will keep you awake.
It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
The more anxious you get about not being able to fall asleep, the less likely you will be to fall asleep.
Just like anxiety about sexual performance.
Exactly. Exactly the same.
It tends to reinforce itself.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's to be done for such people?
Well, usually it's delving down into all those aspects, whether there's underlying depression or mood disturbances, chronic health conditions, behaviors. There are a lot of people now who like to have electronics in the bedroom, TVs in the bedroom, computers, activities that really wake people up right before bedtime, and that we call that sleep hygiene issues. So eating in bed, doing electronics in bed, watching TV in bed, all those hygienic things that we didn't have 100 or 200 years ago that are disturbing our sleep now.
Well, what's the counter? What would you advise to a more or less normal person, but that is not deeply psychopathological and not suffering any major visible disease process, who all the same is insomniac? What kind of practical advice would you give about how to get over it and how to begin to get better sleep?
Well, the first thing I would do would be to ask them to examine their behaviors. Are they drinking caffeine in the afternoon?
Uh-huh.
A lot of people have said to me, and I'm not even a physician, I can't get to sleep at night. And it's 9 o'clock at night, and they're holding a cup of coffee. And so stop drinking caffeine. It's going to be miserable at first, but if you can eventually fall asleep, you won't maybe need as much caffeine anymore. And also, again, like Jim was saying, don't watch TV in bed. Don't have your cell phone with the ringer on right next to you as you're going to sleep. And all of these behaviors that you just have to stop doing and make your bedroom about sleeping and not about work or anything else.
Yes, great advice. So that's a good starting point, I think. Along with certainly medications can have effects on sleep.
Well, I was about to ask you, what about sleeping pills? Should one use those ever?
I think in the right circumstance, they're perfectly fine. The key is, are they appropriate for that unique individual? Why would someone need a sleeping pill to begin with? How long should you use it? Are there behaviors that should also be changed over time that are probably better done? That is, if you change personal behavior, that's probably a stronger medicine than a sleeping pill.
Mm-hmm. I have a habit late at night when I get home after this indulgence of reading a little bit or watching an old movie on television if I can find one, but always accompanied by a cup, maybe two cups in a row of tea.
Hmm.
Now, tea has caffeine, I suppose a little bit less than coffee, I'm not sure.
Black tea has less than coffee, and green tea has less than black tea.
And I drink orange tea.
Orange Pico?
Orange Pico.
That's black tea, yeah.
That is real black tea, I see. Ah, doesn't interfere with my sleep.
Well, maybe it's gotten so late at that point that what we call your sleep pressure overcomes two cups of tea. It's not the same as two cups of coffee before sleep.
Uh-huh. But I find tea rather soothing in a way that I think makes me feel like sleeping. There must be many, many idiosyncratic variables in all of this.
Unique individual. Like some of the treatment, some of the behavioral modification is going to be tailored to a specific person.
And there are certainly a lot of people we see who self-medicate. So the orange Pico tea, it's a routine that actually promotes your sleep, I guess, because it's become a routine. It's established, and you're establishing that tea and that movie with getting then a good night's sleep after that event happens.
I quoted Macbeth earlier, one of the kings of Scotland. What about lying down and counting, reciting to yourself all the kings of England or whatever list you've got?
Well, that list would make me anxious because I can't list one. But if there's something,
again, it's the equivalent of counting sheep.
Right. You know. If there's something that to you doesn't require a lot of mental activity.
Yeah.
And you can do by rote and easily, and you consider it soothing, and it becomes like a habitual behavior that you associate with falling asleep, it may become helpful as long as it isn't a lot of mental work involved.
You're an anthropologist. That's a very significant science. It's the study of essentially human beings and their societies and what acts upon them to shape them and so on. I ask you for a little moment of introspection. Mm-hmm. Reveal yourself. What kinds of things do you think about when you lie down to go to sleep? Do you think, or do you just conk out because you're so fatigued?
No, I do think, because there's always something I'm supposed to be doing. But what I've done is actually created little mental pictures that are always the same, so I don't have to think and have mental activity that I use to try to soothe myself to fall asleep and to try to not think about all the things I'm anxious about.
Little mental pictures. You must go a step further. What do you mean by that?
For example, if I've watched a television show that day, I can just sort of replay the show in my brain because I don't have to make it up. It's been made up for me.
Mm-hmm.
And to try to distract my brain from the things that would make me anxious and keep me awake.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I actually displace thoughts. So the thoughts of the day I try to empty from my brain, and I go through a routine of just body relaxation and empty thoughts, basically nothingness.
You're doing a kind of yoga while prone.
Yeah.
Prone yoga.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I've done that at times as well. An Indian physician I knew was trying to get me to practice yoga, but he never got very far with it. But the notion of lying down and imagining the portions of your body sort of going blank and inactive from the head on down, or working the other way from the toes on up, is a kind of an imaginative task which might lull you to sleep. I don't know.
Yeah, it's actually one of the therapies we'll try for the right individual. That can be quite effective.
That very procedure?
Yes.
Or something like it?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, we're talking about insomnia. That's only one, surely, of a number of pathologies that you worry about, that you treat people for in sleep clinics. What's the rundown? What are the other major sleep pathologies? Just naming the three or four categories.
Well, certainly insomnia is common. It's 30% of the population at any given age or any given time. And there's about 10 to 12% of the U.S. population has chronic insomnia. A common condition in my practice is obstructive sleep apnea or sleep disordered breathing. And that affects about 4 to 9% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
There is, of course, adolescent medicine that we also are involved with. And that involves a little bit of circadian rhythm disorders, limit setting disorders, chronic sleep deprivation. There's a lot of overlap with adolescent sleep disorders.
Particular disorders that accompany adolescence.
Yes.
But fade away once you...
We hope, yes.
...get older. Is that it?
Yes.
Well, let's say a little bit more about that right now. What's the trouble with adolescent sleep?
So adolescents have a little bit of a biological shift in their what we call circadian rhythm or sleep rhythm. They tend to want to go to bed later, and yet at the same time, their social demands require that they get up earlier, usually for high school. And so they're very sleep deprived, and their need for sleep is almost an hour longer when they hit adolescence compared to pre-adolescence. So they're a very sleep-deprived population, and that leads to school performance issues, emotional issues, family issues, etc.
How do you handle that?
Well, I think it's, again, understanding someone's schedule. I will see a lot of kids who are having electronics in the bedroom, you know, having the cell phone on, text messaging at 1 or 2 in the morning, having to go to school and wake up at 6 or 7. And so an adolescent who needs about 9 hours of sleep to feel rested is getting maybe 6 or 7. And that can lead to pretty grumpy, angry kids.
Could lead to even worse than that, I suppose, if they're driving their own cars to school?
Absolutely.
Or, I mean, you can fall asleep when you're supposed to be awake.
Yes.
And endanger yourself.
Yes, absolutely. Especially certain times of the day. So the worst time to be on the road is about 2 in the morning and about 2 in the afternoon or so. That's our lowest point for alertness.
Really? Why 2 in the afternoon?
Well, there's a second dip to our circadian rhythm. Kristen might want to comment better on that. She's certainly one of our circadian rhythm experts.
Why do we call it circadian? What's the etymology
circadian
of the word?
Circadian means about a day. So about a 20, our bodies go through rhythms over a 24-hour period, synchronized with.
And what are the typical circadian patterns?
Well, for alertness or sleep, which are two sides of the same coin, alertness will start to increase in the morning, but then there is a little dip in the afternoon, which a lot of people attribute to having had a big lunch. But the dip's going to happen whether you eat or not. And then the biggest dip, of course, is in the evening around our normal bedtime. When our alertness levels are the lowest, which again is in the middle of the night or in the little period in the afternoon, is when we're going to be the slowest in reacting to, you know, traffic problems. And in fact, study showed that driving sleep deprived is the same as driving drunk.
Yeah. By golly, I've learned something about myself. I sit in the office here at the radio station often doing work on the computer. And if I'm really pursuing something and reading something or just spending a lot of time as I'm Googling or looking for some material I need, I sometimes suddenly do a start and I wake up, realize that I have been asleep for maybe 5 or 7 minutes. It doesn't come at 2 o'clock. It usually comes around 3:30 or 4 o'clock.
Well, everybody's rhythm is going to be slightly
different.
So you may be a little delayed, maybe because you work, you know, you do this radio show from 10 to midnight. So you may have everything occurring a little
bit. But
is
it also a function of age? I confess that I've passed the age of 60 considerably. Do you tend to droop in the corner more as you're older than when you were younger and more vigorous?
As we age, our sleep time does tend to reduce. We're less efficient. We wake up more at night.
Yeah.
And our total sleep time tends to drop off a little bit. So there is maybe a heightened susceptibility during the day, especially in passive situations, watching the computer, trying to read, watching TV, for example, where you might fall asleep.
I guess I'm normal after all.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
For one of the older guys. And one thing that on which I am not normal tonight is I'm not meeting my obligations. We should have gone to the newsroom a minute and a half ago. We'll do it right now. And to Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we return to James Hertigan, MD, who is the head of the sleep lab at University of Illinois, Chicago, and Kristen Knutson, who is a professor, is an anthropologist, a PhD rather than an MD, and is a leading researcher at the University of Chicago Sleep Lab. Is that the same lab that was once run by my old friend and colleague, what was his name again? Al Rechtschaffen.
Al Rechtschaffen. It's a different location. There's been a lot of changes. We are... we're in a different building and we're in a different location, but we are benefiting from his legacy, definitely.
And so it's continuous with that earlier.
There was overlap. So
Great. He was much interested, in fact, in REM and in did this sort of mean thing of waking people up in the middle of REM activations to get their dreams and to look at yet other things. That was a basic routine in that kind of basic methodology in that kind of research.
That was how one of the ways that we determined that REM sleep and these vivid dreamings were linked with one.
Are correlated. But you don't wake up people as much as you used to.
Well, we do because we want to see what happens to them if we wake them up during the night.
Uh-huh. What does happen to them?
We see changes in risk factors for different diseases like diabetes and heart disease. So if we take healthy individuals and fragment their sleep or alter their sleep quality or restrict how much sleep they can get, we see some significant changes in what would be considered risk factors for obesity or risk factors for diabetes. Fortunately, they got better after we let them go.
What sorts of risk factors do you mean?
So changes in glucose metabolism, things like insulin sensitivity, and changes in appetite hormones that regulate your appetite in such a direction that would increase appetite and did in fact increase subjective appetite without changing with the same food intake and the same physical activity. So their appetite should not have changed, and yet it did.
Now, I've seen something that you've written which does claim a close correlation between sleep problems and obesity.
Correct.
Explain in more detail how that works. What mediates it biochemically?
So we're not 100% sure, but some of it is related to, like I said, the link between shorter sleep and changes in the hormones that regulate your appetite.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one hormone called leptin that works as an appetite suppressant. So you would want higher levels, but the levels go down after short sleep. And there's another hormone called ghrelin that's an appetite stimulant. And so those levels go up after short sleep. And we even asked the participants, the volunteers, about their hunger. And their hunger did increase after short sleep. And what was interesting is it didn't increase equally for all food types. It increased more for the high-fat, high-carbohydrate foods like potato chips, French fries, pasta, more so than foods like fruits and vegetables. So it suggests that if we let them eat what they wanted, they may have been more likely to eat junk food than healthier snacks.
Now, so a derivative advice that would come from this order of study, if the study is replicated mm-hmm. and becomes absolutely scientifically confirmed, would be for people who've got obesity problems, sleep more.
That it's possible. What we need to know now is if we extend people's sleep instead of restricting it, go the other side,
yeah.
can we make things better for them? And since we're still not 100% sure how all of this is working, the one thing I can say with certainty, though, is if you're sleeping, you're not eating.
That's true.
Yeah. For the most part. Yeah.
But you could dream of great meals.
Eating, yeah.
yeah. You remember that study done years ago during, I guess, World War II. They took conscientious objectors. This was done up at the University of Minnesota, I believe. And they put them on a near-starvation diet, just barely minimally enough to keep them going. And one of the main findings was that they dreamt constantly. And what they dreamt about was food, food, food. Sex disappeared from their dream life completely.
Well, you need food to live. You don't need sex to live
yeah.
in the short term. So, yeah, the priority was clear in their brain, what they yeah. wanted.
Back to the pathologies. You spoke of apnea. I'm always interested in the etymology of some of these medical terms. Now, apnea, ab, means without what?
Yes. So absence of or cessation of breathing, actually.
The Greek root for breathing is?
So Greek word,
boy. Pneumo.
New, like pneumonia.
So this is apnea is breathing difficulties during sleep.
Yes.
Manifested in what form?
Well, there are several forms of disordered breathing, but the classic is obstruction. So typically obstruction of the upper airway, leading to either partial or complete cessation of airflow into the lungs and low oxygen levels and awakenings. And these can be repetitive and happen once a minute.
You awaken with a gasp and...
Yes, as a protective mechanism to open that airway and start breathing again. But with that gasp, you have a brainwave activation or an arousal. Mm-hmm. So you're waking up and you're not really sleeping.
Is there any danger, pulmonary danger, of somehow so much interference with breathing that you can do damage?
Well, there's damage from having low oxygen levels and leading to high pressures in the lung called pulmonary hypertension. Also, though, systemically in the body, that with low oxygen levels can lead to higher blood pressure. We talked already about blood sugar control and elevations of your blood sugar because of repetitive awakenings and low oxygen levels and obstructive sleep apnea.
Might that facilitate stroke in some older persons?
There's certainly higher associations in people with sleep apnea, usually with an apnea index of 30 or more, with a relative risk of about 2.5 to 3-fold higher risk of having either hypertension or stroke risks or heart attacks.
And what's the connection between all of that and snoring?
So it's a spectrum. So you can have about 50% of the population who snores and maybe 5 to 9% of the population who actually has obstructive sleep apnea. So the two, snoring can be a symptom of sleep apnea, but not necessarily the case.
You just stated something rather startling. Is it 50% of the total population who routinely snore while sleeping?
Right, about 40 to 50% of the U.S. population.
Is that one assumes that comes from sleeping on your back.
It could be positional. About half of people who have sleep apnea are positional. That is, they're worse on their back than their side. It could be because of the obesity epidemic. That is, people are heavier and the greater prevalence of snoring. It could be how we developed as humans. Kristen, I care to comment on why we as humans snore?
I too was surprised by that statistic of snoring. I had no idea it was so high. But I don't know why it evolved. I don't know the snoring prevalence in chimpanzees or bonobos to know when snoring evolved. But it could be structural. it could be related to dry air, perhaps. I don't know if the prevalence of allergies or sinus problems have increased, but it could be related to a variety of factors, I would think.
Sure.
Yeah.
I wonder if it varies with national cultures.
Excellent question. As an anthropologist, that's one thing I'm interested in, is how sleep is different in different parts of the world.
I would think there are differences even in sleep position in different cultures. Is that right?
There are differences in sleep environment. So, you know, when we think of going to bed, we typically think of going into a nice, dark, separated room in a comfy bed with lots of blankets and pillows. But that's not the way sleep is envisioned around the world. Some people sleep is in a communal area where you go in and out of conversations and sleep, and it's not just this defined nocturnal consolidated period of time. It's very different, very different experience. And to ask one of those individuals, how much do you sleep? They would have no idea, because it's not a set period of time. It's in and out.
You know what one of the most condescending things you can say in France about a man that you dislike?
No.
That you think is generally disliked? Il est un dorme seul. He is asleep alone.
There's a painting of a gentleman sleeping on the ground, French painting, I think.
Yeah.
And there's a tiger right hovering above him. And the most...
Oh, that's the famous Rousseau painting.
Right,
yeah.
And then it's supposed to be very disturbing, not simply because there's a tiger right above him, but because he's out by himself sleeping alone.
What difference does it make whether you've got a partner sleeping in the bed with you as opposed to sleeping alone? Do pathologies correlate? Is there more pathology in one situation than the other?
Well, a bed partner is a valuable resource to identify sleep
to
problems,
be sure.
Of course, sleep apnea being one of them.
If you snore, you'll find out from your partner.
That's true. But there is bed partner syndrome. That is, the person who snores is disturbing the person who doesn't snore.
Yeah.
And that's a clear disorder also. Hence the leaving of the bedroom if that snoring becomes too obtrusive.
When I think a lot of it will be related to expectations. If you are from a society where sleeping alone is the worst possible thing because it's unsafe, then sleeping alone might be filled with anxiety and poor sleep quality. But if you're sleeping, you know, in our society where sleeping alone isn't necessarily the worst thing in the world and your bed partner snores, you may prefer to sleep alone and sleep better when you do.
Sure.
There's going to be variety.
We're into interesting territory there. But it is time to pause for some commercials, which we will do. But I think we will now invite telephone calls. We'll get to them directly after the 11 o'clock news. And the lines are open at this moment. The number, of course, as ever, is 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200 for any question you want to raise or any experience you want to share. If you've got questions about some of your own sleep problems, they're welcome, but don't expect a precise and detailed answer. That can't be done over a telephone radio hookup. It needs to be done in consultation with an appropriate physician. All the same, we are pleased to hear from you with any question you've got about sleep, 312-591-7200. And if you hit the busy signal, which may very well happen because our lines are filling up very quickly, don't be totally discouraged, but rather call again after we say goodnight to a prior caller. But there are still a few slots left on the board. And for our distant listeners listening on the internet on other continents or up in my favorite northerly location, Yellowknife, Saskatchewan, or down in Merida in Yucatan, if you want to reach us, the proper way, of course, is via email. The email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 as one word, at WGNradio.com. We'll be with you into the phones after, as I said, the 11 o'clock news. We'll be back to the discussion in studio right after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to conversation with Drs. James Hertigan and Kristen Knutson, both of them involved with sleep research laboratories. James Hertigan at the Sleep Science Center at UIC, and Kristen Knutson at the, what do we call it officially, the Sleep Lab?
We have the Sleep Metabolism and Health Center.
There we are, at the University of Chicago. There are, of course, individual differences in how much sleep one needs. I've always been rather interested in people of apparently high energy who attain a fair amount in life. You get some politicians who just seem to be going all the time, and you learn about them that they don't really need much sleep. Similar claims have been made with regard to certain creative people, whether in science or in the arts as such. Edison supposedly slept very little. Lyndon Johnson bragged that he only needed 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. Another braggart along those lines, but this is confirmed by many who wrote about him after his death, was none other than Napoleon, who insisted that sleep was an annoyance. It gets in the way. You need to do a little bit of it just to restore yourself, but 3 or 4 hours is all that an active man really needs. And then you get on your horse and you ride off to another battle.
Well, sleep need... A lot of people want to know, how much sleep do I really need? And,
yeah.
And it's a very fundamental question, but it's a very difficult answer. Because
but it is really variable across people,
isn't it? It's going to be variable across people, and we have no easy way of taking someone into the lab or the clinic and measuring how much sleep that person needs.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, you know, nice side of being human, I guess, is that we can override our drive to sleep. And so we can wake ourselves up even if our body would like more sleep. And so when someone says, oh, I only need 3 or 4 hours of sleep, I'm skeptical. I know you could actually obtain only 3 to 4 hours of sleep, but there may be consequences either in the short term or the long term. And people are not always the best judges of their state of sleep deprivation, similar to the being able to judge how intoxicated they are.
There's a ritual that one goes through as a young person in college, as final exams are approaching, or even worse, as your doctoral orals are approaching or whatever, that you've just got so much more you've got to cram into your head, and you, quote, pull an all-nighter, assisted either with a lot of coffee or maybe with some other pharmaceutical that's available to you, legitimately or otherwise, and you try to stay up all night just to do the work. I've done it a few, I haven't done it in many years, but I did it a few times when I was a graduate student, in fact. Is that a reasonable undertaking if only as a very temporary expedient?
I think in the short term, many people do it. Many people get through their exams, and many people do pretty well with that. The key, I think, is are they retaining that information a month later? So I think you can cram, you can learn a great deal of information in a short period of time, but whether there'll be retention of that
You're suggesting there will be less retention than information were taken at a more normal pace.
That's right. I think if you could study a subject over a month period of time rather than over a 3-day period of time, your retention is probably better.
I had a friend. I'd be delighted if he were listening right now. He's a professor of psychology down at the University of Illinois, Don Dulaney by name, who he and I were graduate students together at the University of Michigan a very long time ago. And Don had just come back from a stint in the Army. He was drafted or something. It was during the Korean War, I guess. He was going to finish his PhD, and he was shy one language. In those days, when they really worked you hard to get a PhD, less than they do today, you had to demonstrate proficiency in two languages other than your own native language. And he had done his French, but he had to do another one. He didn't know a word of German. And a month before he was due to take the exam, he decided he would learn German by himself. He got some records to listen to, and he read grammars or whatever you read. And I know a little German, and I helped out in terms of some to tell him whether his translation was right or wrong on some particular passage. And he's absolutely aced the German exam. But I doubt that he's still got it. Well, maybe he does retain it. I haven't asked him. I haven't seen him in a while. But you can do things like that, heroic feats of memory if necessary.
It's impressive if and when people can actually do that,
yeah.
And learn a language in a month. But again, like we mentioned earlier on, sleep is important for memory consolidation, meaning taking it from this short-term memory to making it a long-term, more permanent memory. And if you're not sleeping as much, again, like in the long term, are you still going to be able to remember everything you learned? I would think it'd be more difficult, but there's always someone out there who proves, you know, the exception to the rule.
There used to be a bit of a cult, or at least a bit of a fad, for something called sleep learning. There were some commercial outfits that would somehow sell you material that you were supposed to listen to while asleep. Was that just pure nonsense?
Yes.
Simply yes.
Yes, it was.
Yes. Oh,
although I think they made some money with that.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. For a while, it was a fad, as I say.
Yes.
What's hot on the research front in sleep science these days?
So, from our end, we're really, again, really interested in whether sleep itself really does predispose people to risk of developing diabetes or heart disease or obesity, because these are major concerns for the health burden of the United States mm-hmm. and worldwide. And so we really are trying to explore that in more detail.
Earlier, Dr. Hertigan spoke of the obesity epidemic, mm-hmm. assuming or asserting that that is the case in this country right now. I think we all just observationally have noted that that is the case. Do you think it has to do with sleep deprivation, basically?
It may have to do with sleep. Obviously, it also has to do with food intake and physical activity, because weight is based on how much you eat and how much you exercise.
Yeah.
But we think we see an increase in really short sleepers over around the same time period that the obesity epidemic happened, which has only really been since the mid-80s. Today, we estimate at least one-third of the population is obese, and that's getting to be an even larger number as time goes on.
Defining obese by what standard?
So obese using the body mass index of 30. So a body mass index is your height, how much you weigh given your height.
Yeah.
And so if you weigh too much for your height, then you're considered obese. So
30% of all Americans are in that
yes.
category of obesity or worse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Obesity, severe obesity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think only the state of Colorado actually has 19.8% last reported or something like that, obese subjects or obese individuals in the state of Colorado, the healthiest state.
Is that because they have to climb up mountains a lot?
Yeah, perhaps, yeah, or hiking.
Curious.
Yeah. Biking, healthy. Yeah. It's a healthy state.
Uh-huh. What else is of interest in contemporary research?
I think from our perspective, it is a little bit of the social consequences of the obesity epidemic and the health consequences. What are some of the long-term aspects, and how do we create a pattern of behavioral change? As we've seen, this phenomenon has really been happening since 1985, a very short period of time. But it's also led to the consumption of a lot more healthcare dollars, a lot more disease in terms of cardiovascular disease and diabetes. And how do we change that over time? Because we can't even come to an agreement on the debt of the United States. The debt is going to increase further if our population becomes sicker also.
So in the search for general well-being and general health for a national population, sleep pathology becomes one important concern,
Oh, yeah. It's a billion-plus problem for the United States, yes, $1 billion-plus.
Does that refer to the medical costs, or does it refer also to pharmaceuticals that people buy?
Well, I think if you try to tie in not only the work productivity costs, but the pharmaceutical costs uh-huh. and the health consumption costs, it's now becoming a $1 trillion problem.
Goodness.
Whether it's traffic accidents because of sleepy individuals,
uh-huh.
consumption of pharmaceuticals, work productivity, welfare because of the inability to work, it's a very complicated question.
So up you out there during the daytime, but then sleep. Get to sleep early enough.
Yes.
Get the 8 hours. That's a basic advice you would really want to give, isn't it?
Right, to respect sleep more.
Respect
I think
it.
A lot of people think of sleep is for slackers. Hardworking Americans mm-hmm. don't have time for sleep. And I
yeah.
think we need to change that attitude and recognize that sleep is important for health. Eat a good diet, exercise, and get a good night's sleep.
And but stay up until midnight
yeah.
because we want to hear from you, and we want you to hear the rest of this program. 312-591-7200 is the number. As I said earlier, all the lines are taken, but we're going to go to the phones right after we pause for an update on the news. And whenever a phone call is finished, then a line is available, and you can reach for it and try to grab it. And similarly, not similarly, there is no limit on our email load. So if you want to send us an email to raise a question, wherever you are, the email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And with that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Kristen Knutson and James Hertigan, and directly onto your questions and contributions. We'll start tonight with an email. Tom in Geneva, Illinois asks a very simple question. I am surprised that nothing was mentioned about alcohol and its effect on sleep.
Oh, sure. Not only alcohol, but other self-medicating over-the-counter preparations such as Tylenol PM. The main product is diphenhydramine or Benadryl, another trade name. So alcohol has very negative effects on sleep. It does induce sleep or sleepiness. Mm-hmm. However, it does suppress certain stages of sleep and can lead to very fragmented sleep once the alcohol has worn off, which is usually a couple of hours after going to bed.
What about Benadryl? Why do you mention that?
So Benadryl, unfortunately, is a very nonspecific in terms of sleep-inducing, and it can lead to side effects such as dry mouth, dryness. And in the elderly, it has a variable half-life. That is, it can stay in the body up to 9 to 12 hours. So it can have extended sleepiness effects during the day.
Uh-huh. Antihistamines, I suppose, do that a lot too, don't they?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And therefore should be used with some care.
Caution, yes.
We go to the phones now, 312-591-7200. And first up is Laura, who's joined us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. And yes, a very interesting program as always. I look forward to your program.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
I have a question about sleepwalking, and I wonder if your guests can comment on its causes and what can be done about it, etc. And I'll listen to the comments on the radio as I hang up.
All right, ma'am. We thank you for the call.
And thank you.
Sleepwalking.
Yeah, sleepwalking, much more common in children, actually, than adults. But it can lead to either very significant harm if the sleepwalking leads to falling downstairs or walking out windows, walking outside in the middle of winter. I've seen cases where that has happened. I've had children walk outside when it's 30 degrees out and found in a neighbor's front door, knocking on the door. So it can happen. It's pretty rare for that to happen, although that falls into the parasomnia category, sleepwalking, sleep talking, fairly common in children. It should usually resolve by adolescence or adulthood.
Again, another no-no is killing kings. Mrs. Macbeth, after she urged her husband to kill King Duncan, became a sleepwalker. And there's that wonderful scene where she believes she's got blood on her hands. And as she's sleepwalking, she says, "Out, out, damned spot." And then she goes on to say, "But all the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. The rather will it the multitudinous seas incarnadine. It'll turn the seas red with blood." She was much possessed of her own guilt and her own horror at what she and her husband had done. She had not been a sleepwalker before that.
Yes, so if sleepwalking develops as an adult, it can sometimes be a consequence of either medication effects or perhaps a central, I've seen one case of a brain tumor that led to sleep.
Or the doing of a great evil deed and great persisting guilt over it. That's one.
Well,
true in her case.
Yeah, unfortunately, Macbeth probably would be at risk for sleepwalking also because it can have a genetic predisposition. If there's a family member who sleepwalks, there's a higher risk of other family members also doing that.
I'm thinking there are a number of sleepwalkers in Western literature. There is La Somnambula, a great opera by Donizetti or the other one. At any rate, it's a whole opera about a sleepwalker. Excellently performed as well. Back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and Jean has reached us. Good evening, you're on the air.
Hello, I'm calling. My father was undiagnosed, but we suspect had sleep apnea, and myself and my brother have both had sleep studies, complicated ones, that did diagnose sleep apnea. Mine is quite serious. Now I have a son who's in his mid-30s who is a vegetarian, and you can count every rib. He has no possibility of being overweight, and he is starting to snore loudly, and we're concerned about the prospects of obesity. And I did monitor a Dr. Oz program recently where there was a sleep specialist, and he mentioned that there is some kind of a home study, and he mentioned it by name, but I think it's something like Aries or something. And I just wondered whether, obviously, my son needs to go to his primary care physician and discuss it and go from there. But I just wondered if you would have any input that I could mention to him about the situation.
Kristen Knutson does.
Yes. So just to keep in mind that sleep apnea is in individuals who are not obese as well. It's not just a condition among obese. So even though he's lean, it doesn't mean that he's never going to get sleep apnea. And there are tests, more simple tests that can be done at the home. They're not the gold standard. I mean, the best case scenario would be to bring him into a sleep clinic where he can have the full test done. But if he wanted a preliminary screen, there are some. Aries is one company that makes a screening device. There are many companies that make screening devices. And so I would suggest contacting a doctor at a sleep clinic who would have access to some of these different devices and determine what's most appropriate.
All right. Thank you very, very much.
We thank you, ma'am. Glad to have heard from you. What kind of devices are these?
So, the standard test involves putting electrodes on head, face, scalp, and respiratory monitoring, chest belts. You're covered in a lot of different stuff in the sleep clinic. But the devices at home are much more simple, and it depends on which device. Some of them are measuring blood oxygen level. Some of them are still measuring breathing or snoring with a microphone. But they're measuring fewer of these physiological symptoms of sleep apnea. So it's not the perfect measure, which is the one in the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
But it can give you a hint of the possibility of whether or not they have sleep apnea.
Is that the standard procedure for people who think they've got sleep problems? You bring them in and have them sleep for a night while they're hooked up to all sorts of measures?
Yeah, that's right. We call it polysomnography.
Uh-huh.
It is the gold standard. Ambulatory or home sleep testing, HST testing, is emerging as a useful screening tool for select individuals. It still has to be prescribed by a physician and interpreted correctly, which isn't always the case.
We will pause for the usual reasons and then right back to your calls and emails. All the lines are taken, but as I've said for years and years, your best way to get through on a busy night like this is simply to make another very quick call after we say goodnight to a precedent caller. And we'll be on to the next soon-to-be-preceding caller after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
I've been playing with Shakespearean insomniacs tonight, and I've got another one for you. This is from Henry the Fourth, Part 1. And Henry the Fourth, you remember, is Bolingbroke, who essentially toppled a king and indeed killed him. He killed, had Richard the Second killed. And his son, who is Hal and will be Henry the Fifth, is the hero of Henry the Fourth, in fact. But Henry the Fourth is having trouble sleeping also. And he says, "Oh, sleep, oh, gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse, how have I frightened thee, that thou no more wilt weigh my eyelids down and steep my sense in forgetfulness." Again, he's burdened by the guilt of regicide. There must have been an awful lot of that in Shakespeare, an awful lot of concern with that in Shakespeare's time.
Yeah, don't kill a king.
Don't kill a king. It's going to really mess up your sleep.
Yeah.
We go back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and Ed is next up. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, doctor. Enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
My question stems back. I'm a 65-year-old man, and as an adolescent, I can remember quite pleasurable dreams with an associative physical manifestation, if you know what I mean.
I think I know what you mean.
My question is that a hormonal or a libidus-based phenomenon? And second part of the question is it a gender-based phenomenon? I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
I think the man is asking us, do women get sexually aroused by their dreams or in their dreams?
Yes, there is evidence that that is the case. Of course, it's a little bit different. Usually it's associated with increased wetness or, warmth. And it is dream or REM associated, but not as clear as in males as far as REM associated.
And he asks whether male erection during sleep is hormonal or libidinous. Well, obviously it's both. Or
it's a normal physiological event, actually.
Exactly. 312-591-7200, the number, and Jeff is next up. Good evening.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually calling. I have a son who's two, and he actually recently had a sleep study and found out that he had probably moderately to severe sleep apnea. I think they said about 6 apneas an hour, and he said on average each apnea is about stop breathing for about 11 seconds. I don't know how severe that was, but they actually, the doctor scheduled to get his adenoids taken out and his tonsils. I was kind of just wondering, after he gets those out, you know, and heals and everything, how much that will affect the sleep apnea.
Yeah, well, usually in children, tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy is actually the treatment of choice, especially in children who are not severely overweight. The success rate is actually about 85 to 90%. So a two-year-old especially should respond well, assuming it's appropriate clinically. And, of course, you can look in his throat better than I can.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I think the doctor said something about how he probably hasn't from his born. His born had a good full night's sleep, and they said does that possibly affect like growth? Because he's, I mean, on the terms of being intelligent, he's probably at a good 3-year-old level, and they said that they'll improve too. They'll become even, you know, more, you know, even tall. They'll become smarter and, you know, take on stuff. But also, like size wise, does that affect growth? Sleep?
Yeah, there actually was a clinical study that looked at failure to thrive children and those who had sleep apnea who had treatment, which is typically tonsillectomy, adenoidectomy, did show a growth spurt after that surgery.
Okay.
I can't guarantee your son's going to do analytical or quantitative math, though.
He's pretty close. No, he's pretty smart. He's actually... compared to other kids that I know, he's definitely more advanced. So he's got that going. So he needs to grow a little bit. But hopefully it'll help. And thanks a lot for taking my call.
We thank you, sir, for the call. And we'll go quickly to another. And that one is Mark. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Brad. Just a very simple question. I'll hang up afterwards. Can you train yourself to dream?
Yes.
Everybody dreams every night. So you don't need to train yourself. It's just a matter of whether or not you remember them. And in order to remember them, the easiest way is to wake up during REM sleep, which is hard for you to train yourself to do. But another way to remember dreams that people suggest is the second you wake up, to keep a dream journal by your bed and write down as much as you can remember. Because it's a very, it dissipates quickly and it can be forgotten quickly. So if you really want to remember your dreams, then there's a little work involved.
But some years ago, there were some people who sort of specialized, whether they were really psychologists or something else, but specialized in urging people to learn how to control their dreams and to assign themselves certain dream tasks, because that would somehow facilitate their general happiness and also might increase their creativity or productivity with regard to their work or what have you. It was a fad, but I think, isn't there, turning to the anthropologist, aren't there some societies that do, in fact, put a great deal of effort into or a great deal of, who believe that you can dream whatever you choose to dream about and kind of cultivate that as a way of gleaning deeper knowledge than might otherwise be available?
Well, I think dreams have fascinated people for generations around the world, and different cultures are going to treat them differently. And I've heard some cultures where dreams are considered to be prophetic. And
but are the cultures where dreams are assigned, as it were?
Not that I don't know. There could be, but I'm not certain of that. I know of shamanism where dreams are used as part of the practice, but whether any culture has been successful at being able to control their dreams and dictate their dreams, I don't know.
I wanted to read you an email. If I can quickly find it, here it is, that we got earlier on, which raises, and we've got a few other people raising essentially the same question. And so I'm bringing it up so I can read it to you. Here we go. I'd like to ask about a shift work disorder. Is it a real disorder or an attempt by pharmaceutical companies to sell us another placebo drug that we do not need? If it is a real disorder, please have the panel explain the symptoms and how one should cope. I have worked on the second shift for the past 5 years and have experienced weight gain and a definite waking-sleeping pattern shift. So now my normal bedtime is about 5 a.m. daily.
Ugh. Yeah, I think it is a real disorder, and what makes it a disorder is if there are symptoms or the individual experiences problems with daytime functioning or other things. And what makes it a disorder is essentially these people are doing things at the wrong time of day. They're sleeping when they're supposed to be awake, and they're working when they're supposed to be asleep.
He calls it shift work disorder. Is that the common phrase?
Yes.
Shift work disorder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's estimated to affect about a third of our workforce is a non-traditional workforce now. So probably about 15% of those non-traditional workforce individuals have shift work disorder.
Gee, it just occurs to me, I work from 10 to midnight. I'm available for a shift work disorder, am I?
You are at risk of a shift work disorder if you're experiencing some of these consequences.
I've been doing this for 30 years.
Well, you're surviving. That's good.
Yeah.
I would say, though, that if you were drinking those two cups of tea and not falling asleep until 5 in the morning, yes, you would probably have a shift work disorder that we could work on very well for you.
No, I fall asleep as soon as I put my head down. I'm pretty tired by that time. 312-591-7200. And next up is Darren. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi. I just recently changed shifts. I work for UPS, and I went from a day shift to night shift, and I'm finding I'm only managing about 5 hours of sleep. I know I should get more, but unfortunately, you know, you have constraints between family and work, and you know something's got to give. So I've been taking probably 2 half-hour naps, splitting my lunch up, and I was wondering how effective that really was in my overall health and sleep.
Well, the question of naps and its effectiveness in helping reduce the consequences of short sleep, we're still trying to figure out. But the studies that have looked at naps do, in fact, see an improvement in performance and alertness and fatigue. So with respect to those factors, napping is going to help. And I can't imagine that taking a half-hour nap is going to hurt. If you can only get 5 hours at your night, whatever time of day that is, then I think a nap would be beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a Greek study that looked at cardiovascular events, that is heart attacks in those who took naps in the afternoon and those who didn't, and the nappers seem to have a cardioprotective effect from that nap. It does tend to lower your blood pressure a little bit more during the day.
Would napping be just as good if you kind of put your head on the desk and sort of doze for half an hour? Rather than lying in a bed.
Yeah, that deals a little bit with the environment and the quality of that nap and the length of that nap. I would say if you could put a couch in your office instead of laying on your desk, I would do that. I think it'd be a better quality nap.
312-591-7200 is our number. I see that we're approaching the time for another update on the news. And so I'll remind you, in the minute I've got available, you do want to, if you haven't yet or if you haven't lately, you do want to look in on our website at extension 720 at, rather, the way you get to it is wgnradio.com/extension720, where you'll find lots of things, including podcasts from on the first page of some 15 or 20 programs, some of them quite recent, some of them Extension 720 classics. And if you hit where it says the link that sends you to more podcasts, you'll find literally hundreds of older programs that we think well worth your retrieval, and you can download them and listen to them instantly by streaming them or listen to them if you've downloaded on your own device whenever you choose. A lot of our listenership seems to be based upon that as well as direct listening over the air. In fact, some of our programs, we get data on this, have got as many as, what was the highest? I think 500,000 downloads. That was one program of some years ago. But routinely, 40,000 to 50,000 downloads for any recent program is quite common. So that's, if you can't stay up, you got sleep problems, or you got sleep needs, then you can download and listen at your own leisure. With that, we will pause for an update on the news, and for that, once again to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
An email from Mike sends me an interesting item. Another literary figure, Count Basie, really a great jazz man, is quoted as saying, "If you can't sleep, don't count sheep. I don't know that from music of Basie, but I'm sure it's a correct quotation. What do you do if you can't sleep? If you really are just tense with worry about not being able to sleep and you lie there thrashing about, what should you do?
Well, I would say definitely after 20, 30 minutes of doing that, get out of the bedroom.
Yeah.
You know, we'd like to use the bedroom as a positive experience for sleeping, and that is called stimulus control, or trying to take a negative stimulus of not sleeping in the bed, tossing and turning, stop that behavior, get out of the bedroom and try to do some type of wind-down relaxation technique in a different room.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, like trying to take yourself away and identify what is causing the anxiety. And again, like we said before, the harder you try to fall asleep, the less likely it is to happen. So you need to walk away and try to relax and come up with some method for relaxation.
Read a book, listen to a record.
Right.
Look at television.
Yeah, as long as it's not too action-packed and stimulating.
Uh-huh, right. Look at a television station which only has a picture of a continuous fireplace.
There you go,
There are such things, I guess.
Yes, there are.
312-591-7200 as we go back to the phones. Next up is Tom. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. One of the questions that I've had for your guest, and maybe even yourself, when we consider a patient who comes in for a sleep study, and let's say they are not just visually impaired, but they are 100% blind, how do they dream? Do they dream in terms of something they hear, they smell, they touch, or they taste?
Oh, that wonderful neurologist physician who writes about, what's his name, the man, you know the fellow, the Englishman in New York. He's been on this program a number of times. He's well known, and I'm blocking on his name. But Oliver Sacks, exactly. Uh-huh. Thanks to Trey Elling for providing that. Oliver Sacks, in one of his books, has a longest chapter about his study of deaf people, not blind, but deaf people, and old people in some particular town in New England on the coast, where you had somehow a large proportion of deaf people genetically, and as they sit there dozing, he finds them signing with their hands in Amithlan.
So talking in their sleep.
They're talking in their sleep with their hands. Yeah. What do we know about blind people dreaming?
I don't know anything. It's a very interesting question. I assume it would be more an issue for people blind from birth. If you became blind, you'd probably still have visual dreams.
Sure.
But if you've never seen whether or not your dreams are visual, I don't know. It's a very interesting question.
That's the best we can do with it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate that. And we'll go to Irene. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. I'd like to ask your guest the question, please.
Yes.
What causes night terrors in small children, and how do you handle that?
Carefully.
Yeah. true. So night terrors are not that unusual in children. It can be a spectrum. It can be just simply sitting up and screaming or screaming in their sleep. It could be rare, once a year, or it could be more frequent. It depends a little bit on all those variables as far as whether it's a daily or that is nightly phenomenon or is happening rarely and is in response to some anxiety-provoking event. That is, they were exhausted and tired that particular day or sleep-deprived. That can bring on night terrors. Or, a very exciting event or a scary event that they had experienced that day or a few days earlier.
It is rare, but how do you take the child and hold it and try to hold it? Because they sort of fight with you when you're holding them too tight, I think.
That's right. I would not try to physically engage a child who's screaming unless you think they're going to hurt themselves. That is, they're screaming and then running down the hall and about to run into a glass pane window or down the stairs, something like that. If they're just shouting, screaming, that usually is very self-limited and they should, be not necessary to console them.
It should subside within a couple of minutes, are you saying?
Yeah, it should be quite brief.
All right. The physician is aware of this, but I was just wondering for myself, how does one handle that?
Yeah, I think more of the question is it frequent?
No.
Can it be precipitated by, for example, a very active day or a sleep-deprived day, or maybe they, you know, got into too much caffeine. You know, there's some precipitating factors that can increase the risk.
It is an active child, and a lot of times it doesn't want to take a nap. So I think it's overwhelmed by the evening. But thank you very much.
We thank you, ma'am, for the call.
You're welcome.
And we'll go directly to another on 312-591-7200. And Dean is up. Good evening, sir.
Yes, I've been using a CPAP machine and mask for about a week now. But since I live alone, as referenced earlier, I don't really have anyone to sort of help me evaluate the effectiveness of the machine and the mask. And I was wondering if there is a way that I can self-evaluate the effectiveness of it. And secondly, are alternatives available to the mask and CPAP, like the cheaper anti-snoring device that's being sold out there, on up to something more extreme as surgery, and what the effectiveness of surgery might be?
Well, very interesting. Let's get very clear as to what a CPAP machine is.
So CPAP stands for continuous positive airway pressure. So it's a device that is forcing air into the person's airway, throat, through their nose, to keep it open, to keep it from collapsing in the cases of obstructive sleep apnea where their throat collapses. In terms of determining whether it's effective, my first question is, do you feel better? Do you feel less, more rested? There are more objective ways. The device itself may be measuring whether or not it's clearing up your sleep disordered breathing. And then I want to defer to Dr. Hertigan for alternative treatments.
Yeah, Dean, you're certainly not alone. Hopefully, after a week, you do notice a difference in the quality of your sleep. A lot of the newer machines do have microchip circuitry that can look at some forms of effectiveness. That is, the length of time you're using it, the leaking of the mask. That is the mask leaking too much? Is it fitting properly or not? So there are, and some of these machines can now detect whether you're still having sleep apnea when you're using the machine. So that can be downloaded and reviewed by your physician. And then as far as alternatives, it depends a little bit on the severity of the sleep apnea. There are mouthpieces, or what we call mandibular advancement devices. They're usually custom fit to try to advance the lower jaw and open up the airspace in the back of the throat. Sometimes upper airway is performed, and again, that's individualized, and it is for the appropriate patient with the right anatomy that might be treatable by surgery.
Okay, thank you very much.
We thank you, sir. I'm going to take a moment again to talk about what's available to you or for you on our website with regard to the downloadable programs that we have right here now in podcast form. Last night's program, of course, with Richard Minter, who has done a definitive study about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who ran the 9/11 operation and killed some 5,000 people, 3,000 in that one occasion. That program is there. We did it just last night. It's, I think, of considerable interest. And other recent programs are up and waiting for you if you haven't already heard them over the air, including our program on human evolution with two members of the anthropology department at UIC, in fact. Joe Walsh, the Illinois congressman from the 8th District, who's in the news again today for another reason, was with us a few nights ago, as were three people from the Lincoln Park Zoo. A Night at the Zoo is one of the programs that's still up. When it comes to the classic programs available to you, I'll just run down the list quickly, naming who the guests were. Carl Sagan, way back a number of years ago, of course. A program on religion versus science through the ages with, among others, the distinguished British author A.N. Wilson. Let me see here. Yes, Jim Lovell, commander of Apollo 13, a program of about 10 years ago. An evening with President Carter's kin. This is a rare one. Ruth Carter Stapleton and Billy Carter and a friend of mine, Jim Wall, who worked for President Carter way back in those days. This program was way back to 1978. It's the oldest one on the site at the moment. Harold Kushner, Rabbi Kushner, the author of, among other things, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Mayor Harold Washington. We found that one a while ago. I found it at home. We put it up on the air. Fascinating. The great public quality of Mayor Harold Washington is readily available, as is the interesting performance by Henry Kissinger, another by the good Senator McCarthy, Eugene McCarthy, David Mamet, and a wonderful program. You may not know this fellow, Frederick Cruz. He's a professor of English, but he really is a great skeptic and sees through a lot of junk, including, in fact, psychoanalytic theory, on which he's written quite definitive stuff. That's available to you, as is a program with our great and popular guest on this program, the Chicago crime reporter John Drummond, and Winston Churchill's grandson, in a program about Churchill and America. Those are only the things that are on the front page. If you hit where it says more archives or more programs, you'll find literally hundreds of others. So we urge you to try that out if you haven't already, or return to it if you haven't been there in a while. We will be directly back after we pause for a last round of commercials.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to James Hertigan and Kristen Knutson, and quickly back to the phones on 312-591-7200. Carolyn has joined us. Good evening.
Hi there. Thank you so much. My sleep challenge is not insomnia, but I never awaken refreshed. And I understand that something that is common of people with fibromyalgia and other things that might affect sleep quality. And I've been using BiPAP for many years, and it did bring improvement in my sleep, but I still do not awaken refreshed.
What is BiPAP?
Something natural for me.
Yeah, so BiPAP is like CPAP, but it has a variable pressure when you're breathing in versus breathing out. Why do you use BiPAP?
It was recommended for me because I'm also challenged on the exhale.
Okay, so there is obstructive sleep apnea present?
Yes.
Okay, I see. Well, unrefreshing sleep, a common complaint, not only with people who have sleep apnea, but for other health reasons. I would think some of those answers might be explained in a sleep study that you probably have had, but maybe not. I don't know how long ago that sleep study was, but we can look for other things that might influence sleep quality, like leg movements at night called periodic limb movements, or frequent arousals, or maybe the BiPAP machine pressure needs to be adjusted because now it's waking you up more than it did in the past. Those are some possibilities. Other medications can certainly lead to feeling fatigued or unrefreshed in the morning or throughout the day. I don't know if I'm hitting on anything close.
No, they've been through all that pretty much, unfortunately. I sleep all night long without being awakened, but when I get up in the morning, it's just like I took maybe an hour or two.
How many hours of sleep do you get?
I can go up to 9 straight hours and still not be refreshed when I wake up.
Well, if you're in, you may not be actually sleeping. If they're, you know, waking up briefly, you may not remember waking it up. And you said you had fibromyalgia, which, if it's pain, was one of the things we mentioned earlier on that can impair sleep quality because the pain itself may be waking you up and you're just not aware of it. I would have thought they might have caught that in the PSG, the sleep test that you would have done, unless it's gotten worse since your sleep test. And so maybe your sleep quality has deteriorated since your last sleep test. I don't know how long it's been.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Well, thank you, ma'am. Here's an interesting email that's come in. I wonder if the term insomnia, like the term schizophrenia, has fallen into careless usage. Many of us who cannot seem to stabilize as night sleepers nonetheless sleep deeply in the day, and we like being up all night. And when I've gone overseas to the UK, one afternoon nap upon arrival has me back on the same cycle, wakeful and vibrant, well into the wee hours. I've never suffered from jet lag, though the return to the U.S. is a slightly less facile adjustment. If insomnia is inability to sleep at all, that's not what I deal with. Are there simply people wired to be at their best during the night?
Yes. There are people we consider to have what we call a delayed sleep phase, meaning they fall asleep later and they wake up later during the day. Everything seems to occur a little bit later relative to the classic 9-to-5 workday schedule. And if you're perfectly happy living like that, then you don't have a problem. But some people want to try to work 9-to-5, and so those individuals are considered to have the delayed sleep phase syndrome and come to the sleep clinic to try to get help with their circadian rhythms to try to be able to fall asleep earlier.
Yeah, and just to clarify, we would not call that insomnia, actually. Right. We would call it a circadian rhythm shift, not necessarily a disorder if you're functioning fine. And we sometimes use the term owls and larks as far as the percentage of people who are owls, that is, tend to like to stay up late, is maybe 30 to 40% of the population has that tendency.
And let's go quickly back to the phones. A few more calls to be worked in before we quit for the night. And here is Steve. Good evening.
Hi, Milt. Oh, it's a thrill and an honor to talk to you. Thank you for all the great shows you've done. A quick comment and then a question. I had a sleep study done at a regional hospital here, a pretty reputable hospital. And you had mentioned that they put electrodes on you for the sleep. And I don't sleep well. And when I went there, and the room at the sleep lab is like a motel room, right? And so they went to put these electrodes on. And I'm thinking, my goodness, I'll never be able to sleep with these electrodes on. But I hit.
I'm afraid your phone is abandoning you. The call is lost. I think he was about to tell us that he slept quite well with the electrodes on.
Yes, hopefully. He didn't get electrocuted out there.
Apparently not. Let's go to another caller. Todd is up. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you for taking the call.
Yes, sir.
I have been taking Ambien, small dosage, 5 milligrams and less, for an extended period of time to help fall asleep. Is there any long-term effects that I should be concerned with?
Yeah, so that deals with the use of chronic sleep aids, and for the right patient, it's perfectly fine, especially if you're not having noticeable side effects. The downside sometimes is that there is tolerance that develops. That is, the medication becomes less effective. If you can go through holiday periods without the medication, perhaps that'll help with that. 5 milligrams is a reasonably low dose, and if you're not having many side effects and you find it beneficial for you, I don't think there's anything serious to worry about.
Are there memory issues or other things that would be affected by this drug during the day?
There certainly can be. A number of reports have come out with the use of Ambien or other sedative hypnotics as far as having an effect on memory or remembering things from the day before.
And, sir, we thank you for the call, and we'll go quickly to the next caller. And that one is Pam. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. I have all of my life, I am now 65 years old, and all of my life I haven't slept very much at all. I don't nap during the day. I sleep maybe between 4 and 6 hours a night, and that's it. I also don't ever remember dreaming. I go to bed, I read maybe for 10 minutes, I go to sleep, and I wake up in the morning about 5:30 to 6 when the sun comes up, and I'm off for the next day. Is there a potential issue here, or am I just extraordinarily lucky that way?
It's hard to say exactly, but we do know, like we'd mentioned before, that sleep need is going to be different for different people. And recently there have been people identified as natural short sleepers, and that there's a genetic link to this. So it may be that you're a natural short sleeper. 6 hours is actually not too low amount. It's not too bad.
Yeah,
4 hours.
That's on a good day. Most nights I get between 3 and 4 hours.
Okay. If you feel you're functioning well during the day, I don't know how concerned I'd be. Did you want to add anything about four?
No, I think if you're highly functional, if you don't feel impaired, you don't feel like you're exhausted or you're, you know, numb in the brain, I think that's fine.
Nope, I'm good there. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
More power to you. Thank you.
Thank
you for the call. And we'll work in one more very quick call, and here is Tom. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I didn't hear my name. Yeah, I just a couple comments.
Now, wake up there.
The CPAP works fine because I've been using it for a couple of years, so the guy that just started, he ought to stick with it because I would always fall asleep in the sofa 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening and leave the dishes to be washed in the morning, and I clean up the dishes and everything, and they're not there in the morning. But a couple things. Seems like I don't remember dreams as much as I used to, and I used to be a terrible snorer, everybody told me. And one of the things, though, that I miss that I don't do with the CPAP, because when I before the CPAP, I would have such light sleep, I guess, that I would be conscious and aware that I'm talking in my sleep or singing in my sleep. And I find now that with the CPAP, I can't talk or I can't sing.
You are an interesting case, but we only have...
Excuse me, sir, I have to interrupt you
because we only have about a minute and we have to go off the air. Any reactions to what he's telling us?
Well, he describes, very common reduction of sleep talking, sleep walking in sleep, consolidation of sleep, improved depth of sleep, and remembering dreams sometimes doesn't happen if you're not waking up out of those dreams.
So CPAP has served him well.
Sounds like it.
And you have served us very well tonight. Thank you so much for coming. Our guests have been James Hertigan, MD, who is a professor of clinical medicine and medical director of the Sleep Science Center at UIC, and Kristen Knutson, who is an anthropologist and professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago at their sleep lab there. We will be back again Sunday night for just a one-hour program, talking with an informant from Paris, who's done an interesting new book. You'll learn more about that at 11 o'clock Sunday night. And then we continue with sort of a medical series on Monday night. Three physicians from the relevant medical centers around town join us, an oncologist, a cardiologist, and a neurologist. We'll talk about what's happening in those important fields of medicine. Until Sunday at 11, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.